Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Essayist and high-toned pundit George Will has been commenting on American life, American politics, and American conservatism for more than three decades now. He was there before and when American conservatism took off in the years of Ronald Reagan, there for Washington's Republican Revolution in the 1990s, here now for what he calls a moment of doubt and rancor about what it means to be a conservative. This hour on Point, George Will on the country and American conservatism. Joining me now from Washington is George F. Will, Pulitzer Prize winning columnist for The Washington Post and Newsweek, one of the most prominent commentators of our time on everything from politics to baseball, and in his latest book, also lingerie and duct tape. He's a regular commentator on ABC's This Week. His column is syndicated in 450 publications. He's been writing his post column for 34 years now and on ABC nearly as long. His new book is One Man's America, The Pleasures and Provocations of Our Singular Nation. George Will, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be with you.
Wonderful to have you. Lingerie and duct tape and politics and baseball, it's quite a stew you've got here, and you start right off in your introduction for a conservative like you. By the way, what happened to the bow tie and wire-rimmed glasses? I missed that. They're gone. You're more normal. Are you giving up your affect?
No, I wear the bow tie less because it began to seem like a costume, and the point of the well-dressed gentleman is not to be noticed.
All right. Well, fully taken on board then, but I can't quite get used to your Rotary Club attire now. Doubt and rancor about what it means to be a conservative. What are you referring to, and what's the source of the doubt and rancor?
Well, the source of the doubt is that conservatives, when I cast my first vote for president in 1964 for Barry Goldwater, and subsequently have been able to say in a few pithy expository sentences what it means to be a conservative: limited government, robust national defense, of course defined largely for most of that time by hostility to the Soviet Union and containment and all that involved.
Yeah.
The trouble is that conservatism in 1964, when I voted for Goldwater, was a church militant in an unconverted world, so small that it couldn't even have much in the way of factions and schisms.
Right.
Now it has become a mainstream, at least at parity with liberalism as a political doctrine competing in the marketplace of ideas. It has grown, and as it's grown, the tent has been full of fractious factions. Now, some of us think that Madison was right, that there should be a saving multiplicity of factions, makes life healthier. Mm. But it's made life uncomfortable for a great many conservatives. And after the years of governance, the 12 years since the Republicans took control of the House in 94 and lost it in 2006, conservatives became all too comfortable in Washington, all too comfortable using the spending power to try and purchase perpetual power in Congress at the direct cost of the clarity of their brand and the conviction with which they could say they favored limited government.
Let me ask you, so many questions here, but I guess the big one on my mind is you've been, elucidating conservatism and promoting conservatism for a very long time, bringing this perspective to bear. And now here we are, you've been in the post for 34 years, and we had Reagan in those years and the Republican Revolution. And you've got your latest collection. You've had so many books out, but in this one you're talking about the United States being in bleak years, not happy times. How does it feel after all those decades of conservative ascendancy, the project you've been working on, for the country to seem, not in all ways, but in many important ways, in a very tough spot? Does it give you pause about what you've promoted?
I think people feel much more bleak about the future than they should. I don't think the country is in a tough spot compared to spots it's been in before. I mean, we just went through, I thought, a remarkably civil contest for the Democratic nomination. But people kept saying this rancorous, bitterest fight between Obama and Hillary Clinton. What rubbish if you've read something about the 1800 election, or if you remember other elections that were equally bitter. The country is up in arms about its economic difficulties, which, though real, are nothing as they were, say, in 73 and 74, when the Dow Jones lost 46% of its value, when we had a misery index, that's combining inflation and unemployment, over 20, when we had interest rates in double digits. A little perspective. I'm afraid that we've had it so good for so long that we now have an absurdly low pain threshold and are in danger of becoming the crybabies of the Western world.
And yet it's you characterizing these as bleak years, the miasma of anxiety. I mean, when you headed out of Michigan, where you were teaching and became a real public figure and began to really beat the drum for the conservative view in a very prominent way in the 1970s, did you ever imagine, that the movement would be so successful, that it would come to be mainstream, perhaps even for a while there at least, more prominent than its opposite perspective? But more importantly, did you imagine that on the other side of 30 years of something like ascendancy, the country would be in this kind of situation?
Well, markets go up and markets go down in oil and stocks and political fortunes. That's part of the rhythm of things. So I'm not absolutely scandalized or traumatized by the fact that fortunes vary. Certainly when I left graduate school, I got my PhD at Princeton in 67 and started teaching at Michigan State, and a year later at the University of Toronto. I intended to be a teacher, as my father was then and was for 30-some years professor of philosophy at the University of Illinois. And that means I went on to campuses in 67, 68, 69. Now, you can remember what the campuses were like then. If you remember the country then, you remember the campuses were the country squared. Not a congenial time for someone of my persuasion. So coming from a minority persuasion in the country and a distinctly minority position on campuses where I was, to, as I say, parity in a country that is, no matter how it votes this year, is and remains a center-right country, is a satisfying enough progress that while I'm not pleased with the discredit conservatism has brought upon itself in recent years, I take a little bit of the long view, as markets encourage one to do. And again, I say political as other markets go up and down.
David Brooks, in George Packer's big piece in the New Yorker magazine recently, quoting a lot of conservatives, wringing their hands about the state of American conservatism today. And David Brooks, now columnist for the New York Times, he's, of course, done the Stations of the Cross in the conservative publishing world. He's quoted there saying, or describing a situation where now most conservatives seem incapable of even acknowledging the central issues of our moment: wage stagnation, inequality, health care, global warming. They're stuck in the past, is the kind of summary that Packer takes away. Conservatives stuck in the past or still somehow holding the future?
Well, I would probably differ with David on a number of those issues, including wage stagnation, the broadening inequality, and climate change. But basically, I think the proper conservative stance is that of Ronald Reagan, who said, "I do not want to go back to the past. I want to go back to the past way of facing the future." And that means on the basis of certain truths. Conservatives, like liberals, just different point of view, we believe our advantage is that we have the truth. Not all of the truth, but that our basic premises have been validated by history. If I had to pick an intellectual pinup from among the founders, I'm a Madisonian, and I believe conservatism is the Madisonian persuasion about the fact that the people are a problem, democracy is a problem, government is a problem, and you try and find, as he said, Republican remedies for the diseases to which republics are prey. So politics is always a problem. Politics isn't, in Madison's view, an exhilarating crusade. I guess to make it more timely, I'd say it's not the kind of Obama salvationist movement. It's a gritty business of trying to minimize the damage that must be done because government must be done.
And yet, you know, I wonder if on the other side of all these years, you hadn't expected that a period of conservative politics, markets up and markets down aside, might not have produced something a little more felicitous than what you're looking out on today in this great republic of ours.
Well, I certainly hoped for that, but one tries in life, and it's particularly imperative for conservatives to separate hopes from beliefs. Conservatives have a saying that for conservatives, seeing is believing, and for liberals, believing is seeing. Conservatives like to say they are impeccably empirical. And we understand that nothing lasts, that change is the only constant in our society, and that there are rhythms in society. You know, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. Made much of the cycles of American history. We might quibble with his assessment of them and B, his sense of the timing of them, but he's right. There are cycles in American history, and we may be on the verge of a liberal cycle with a big asterisk over it. The liberal cycle always means more energetic government. And if Mr. Obama becomes president, he's going to become president in the second year of a demographic deluge that began last January when the baby boomers began to retire. And as they retire, and as Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid swallow the federal budget, the room for energetic government is going to be severely circumscribed.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with George Will, conservative columnist and author of the new collection of essays, One Man's America. George Will, I want to ask you, The Economist magazine, or newspapers they like to call themselves, though they look like a magazine to me, cover says it's got John McCain and Barack Obama on the cover, and it says America at its best. It says America's history of reinventing and perfecting itself has acquired another page. On the face of it, this is the most impressive choice America has had for a very long time. George Will, do you agree?
I think it's a good choice, and we're going to have a quite normal election, aside from the fact that for only the third time in American history, 1920 Harding, 1960 Kennedy, we're going to elect a sitting member of the Senate, and for the first time in American history, we'll have a presidential race between two sitting senators. Aside from that, it's quite orthodox left-right, discernibly conservative, discernibly liberal. One quite notably intelligent, Obama, one quite notably experienced, John McCain, and let's fight.
You've been very tough on John McCain through your columns over time. What's the core of your gripe with Senator McCain?
Well, I hold the Olympic indoor and outdoor records for most anti-McCain columns written. He, as you know, his base is in the media, which, until he became the Republican nominee, was a great fan of his, for three reasons. I think the McCain-Feingold legislation is the most dismaying passed in my decades in Washington, because the government, the legislature specifically, has asserted the right to regulate the content, timing, and quantity of political speech about the legislature.
So a First Amendment problem to you.
Or a problem with what John McCain rather dismissively once called the so-called First Amendment rights. Well, they're not so-called rights to me. Second, I do worry about his foreign policy. He has said, regarding Iran, which is much the biggest problem that the next president will face, he has said regarding Iran that the only thing worse than a war with Iran is a nuclear-armed Iran. Since I see no realistic hope of preventing the achievement of nuclear weapons by Iran. And I particularly see no reason to rest great hopes, as John McCain does, in what he calls a league of democracies that will somehow materialize, step up, and impose effective sanctions. The logic of his position is war with Iran, which I think would be a calamity, because the Iranian people are the most pro-American publics in that region. And America, stretched as thin as it is, cannot, it seems to me, promiscuously go to war with a nation of almost 70 million people.
And number three?
Cap and trade. If you buy into, which I do not, the excitement about global warming, and if you believe that carbon must be regulated, cap and trade is an absurdly baroque way of doing this. If you have the courage of your convictions on this, you must favor a carbon tax, which is direct, effective, candid. Whereas the political class in Washington divides its time between saying this is the gravest crisis ever to face us, but we're not going to do anything that will get us in trouble by having a candid tax. Instead, they would erect a cap-and-trade regime wherein the federal government would allocate ration, really, and auction off the right to carbon emissions, thereby creating the greatest bonanza in history for the lobbying community in Washington, which John McCain professes to despise.
Because those Washington would then take those billions, trillions ultimately, and allocate them. They say they'd allocate them to push alternative energies, retraining for workers displaced, to underwrite the cost of moving to a new energy regime. On the face of it, that sounds like it's going to take some investment.
Yes. Well, Joe Lieberman, who is, of course, McCain's boon companion out on the trail, Lieberman, who is the co-sponsor with John Warner of the Senate bill, estimates that the government will reap by auctioning permission to do business to businesses, it will reap $7 trillion, $7 trillion by 2050. What would it do with it? Well, it would dole out benefits to particular client groups. It's Christmas, perpetual Christmas, 365 days a year, year after year, for the political class in Washington.
But step back for a second on that front, George Will, and look at how the markets have done. I mean, GM, you know, cut back after cut back last week, talking about getting rid of Hummer now, but they've still been building Hummers and SUVs as we've gotten deeper and deeper into what most of the scientific world agrees is a big problem. Has it not been a market failure, at least in the United States?
Not true. We've now passed a point where we're selling more four-cylinder than six-cylinder cars.
Yeah, but come on, Japan is absolutely the leader in hybrids. Germany's taken over solar power. Are we not, with our market drive, for whatever reason, lagging way behind on this front?
The market is punishing Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors. The market is doing with ruthless efficiency what government, with its cumbersome mandates, has not yet got around to trying to do. The market is working splendidly.
Splendidly. Not so great if you're working for GM or trying to buy an American car that doesn't gulp gas by the tanker load.
Buy another car. And that's what free trade allows us to do if Mr. Obama will let us still have free trade.
We've got a lot of listeners who want to speak with you. Let's go to Chesapeake, Virginia, and Jay. Jay, you're on the air with George Will.
Thank you. I have a comment and a question. My comment is that whenever, and I'm embarrassed to say this, but whenever the local NPR menu does not suit my palate, I have on occasion listened to conservative talking heads like Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity.
It's a free country, Jay. Go get them.
Okay. And, you know, when I listen to these guys, I hear some very clear messages. And the messages are the free markets are going to solve everything. Freedom is a word that they toss around a lot. Freedom to do what? I'm not quite sure. And that you got to be a little bit evangelical and Christian to fit into this club. My question is this. Has George Bush and Dick Cheney and all of the conservatives who shut their mouths and pulled the party line through his administration has soured America on conservatism forever? Because when you think conservative, you're going to think Dick Cheney, George Bush, Rush Limbaugh, Neil Bortz.
Jay, where did you start 8 years ago? Are you a natural born conservative or liberal or somewhere in between?
No, I am a Lou Dobbs independent populist.
And feeling kind of sour. George Will, what do you say, Jay? That is a big question sitting out there. Pew Research Center finds 60% of voters under 30 now say they identify more strongly with the Democrats, double that party's advantage since 2004. Jay wants to know if it's soured forever.
Forever is an awfully long time.
Yes, it is.
Jay.
How about a long time?
Well, let me point out that in 1964, where we began our conversation, Barry Goldwater lost 44 states, suffered the biggest defeat up to that point in American history, and 4 years later, the Republicans won the White House. Things change awfully fast in this country. Now, I share Jay's unease about the Republican dependency on evangelical Christians, perfectly sound Americans, like most other Americans in most ways politically, but there is a worrisome aspect that's manifested itself in the Terri Schiavo case about a party that, in the 2006 elections, got 46% of its votes from white Christians, a party that, in 2006, got more votes from evangelical Christians than Democratic candidates got from African Americans and union members combined. I share his anxiety about that. I do not share his anxiety, if I read him right, about the Republican emphasis on freedom to do just about whatever you like. I think that's the default position in a free society. It's certainly the default position among conservatives. But what Jay points to is indeed the shape, the evolving contours of the liberal conservative argument. It has organized our two parties around the two values, both very valuable, always in tension, freedom and equality. Conservatives tend to stress freedom and to be willing to accept larger inequalities of social outcomes consistent with freedom. Liberals tend to stress increasingly trying to engineer more equality, generally by enlarging government entitlement programs, and therefore they tend to see the multiplication of entitlement programs, which conservatives looks like the multiplication of dependency, as a definition of the public good.
Isn't that kind of out of date, George?
Will, oh, heavens no, it's
government
getting more.
Government entitlement, the end of welfare as we know it. I mean, I've heard Democrats talking for most of the 90s about opportunity, equal opportunity, and long before that, but opportunity, not entitlement.
Let me let you again go back to the demographic deluge. We are in an aging society. The welfare state exists to transfer wealth from the working young and middle aged to the retired elderly.
So, Social Security,
today,
you're talking about.
Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid are already 40% of the budget.
Should we have impoverished elders?
On the current trajectory. On the current trajectory, by 2050. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and interest on the debt, those four things will consume 20% of GDP, which is what all of the federal government today consumes. What I'm saying is we, you know, some national problems come as 9/11 did, as bolts from the blue, as Pearl Harbor did. This is absolutely conspicuous, predictable, inevitable, and no one wants to talk about it.
Would we be better off if we weren't saddled with the very large inequities that have emerged in this period of Republican dominance? The distribution of wealth in this country getting more and more skewed to the point that even some very, very wealthy individuals, you know, are speaking out about it. Is that part of the problem? If we spread it around a little more, might we be in a better position to face this period ahead, this time of trial you're talking about?
Well, first of all, you say even the very wealthy, the extremely wealthy, the Warren Buffetts and Bill Gates are not, it seems to me, a useful sample for gauging American opinions about, as you put it, spreading things around. The government, when it spreads things around, remember, it will spread them around in response to political pressures. Republicans believe that the market is a more rational and, at the end, more just distributor of income than government responding to intense pressures here in Washington.
But isn't some amelioration what most Americans seem to want? I mean, the inequities that we see in our economy now are as big as they've been in, what, 80, 90 years? Much bigger than they were at the height of the American century, the height of American prominence and respect in the world.
With your use of the word inequity, you are assuming what I think needs to be argued and established.
Okay.
That there has been a widening disparity of economic reward is indisputable. However, it is sometimes exaggerated because when we talk about wages, we sometimes do not talk about compensation, which is not the same thing, because an enormous amount of compensation through health care goes untaxed and not recorded as wages. But beyond that, two centuries ago, the great source of wealth in the world was land. A century ago, it was fixed capital. Think of Andrew Carnegie's steel mills, Cornelius Vanderbilt's New York Central. Today, the widening disparity reflects directly a new source of wealth, mind, education. You earn what you learn. And what we're seeing is a radically increased return on education. Now, that is not necessarily a bad thing. We could cure it by getting Americans to drop out of school sooner, but the more we educate, we are going to see disparities, again, radical returns on education. And that's not an unambiguously bad thing to have the market screaming at the top of its lungs, stay in school.
But I think something, I don't have the number, but isn't it half or more of Americans go to college now, but we've got wealth concentrated in the top 1 or 0.1%. I mean, college doesn't guarantee you any piece of that these days.
Yes, but then to go back to your verb about spreading things around, the top 1% of income earners pay 39% of the income taxes. The top 5% of income earners pay 60% of the income taxes. The bottom 50% of income earners pay 3% of the income taxes. How much more spreading around do you want the government to do?
Well, on the opportunity front, I think maybe we need a lot of opportunity spread around, but let's hear from our listeners. Another one from Chesapeake, Virginia. Brad, you're on the air.
Hi, Dom and
Hi.
Mr. Will. How are you?
Hi.
I really just wanted to make a comment and to thank Mr. Will for your writing skill. I consider myself liberal, and your commentary and your opinion, as they're written without rancor, they're written without vitriol towards the other side, which would be mine. And because of that skill, that allows me to see things from the conservative viewpoint without all the fluff and the filler that often permeates political journalism today. And I truly, truly appreciate it. And I just wanted to finally say that to you. I've been reading your articles for quite some time, and I was very happy to have this opportunity. Thank you.
Brad, that's great. They've been out there for a long time, and a tip of the hat to you, George Will, for that. Let's get one more here from Andover, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, George.
Hi.
I grew up in my formative years watching you, and my first voting time was when Reagan ran in 1980. And so I always voted Republican, being fiscally conservative. But when I watch things like, you know, the bailout of Chrysler or the bailout of Bear Stearns, it would just seem that your free market stance and also the stance that, oh, let the markets take care of themselves, it seems like today's Republican Party's kind of talking out of both sides of its mouth. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I agree with you, but do not blame me for Chrysler or Bear Stearns. Let me take them one at a time. In the late 1970s, when the government undertook to save Chrysler because it was, and it sounds quaint to say so at the time, it was too big to fail, I called a friend in the New York business community and said, what should I think about this? He said, the danger isn't that this will fail, but that it will work and that it will whet the appetite of government to intervene in the economy like this. The friend I called in New York in the late 70s was named Alan Greenspan. I opposed the Chrysler bailout. We just prolonged its life for what I think may be a later demise. I am absolutely appalled that the Federal Reserve has gone beyond its core function, which is to preserve the currency as a store of value, that is to control inflation, and is now brokering deals, as it did between Bear Stearns and J.P. Morgan Chase. I may be wrong, but I'm sure consistent on this one.
But doesn't that fly in the face of your lauding conservatism for its defense of the market?
No, I am still defending the market. If there are some apostate conservatives out there, including many in power, that is, it may be... Maybe I'm partly to blame for them getting there, but I'm sure not leading the cheers for them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with George Will, conservative columnist, author of the new collection of essays, One Man's America. The bow tie is gone, but he's still carrying the torch for American conservatism, worried about apostates in power. George Will, listen with us for just a second, if you would, to a little bit of John McCain. Here he is at the Conservative Political Action Conference earlier this year, looking to reassure the GOP base that he's one of them and that he could win.
I will stand on my convictions, my conservative convictions, and trust in the good sense of the voters and in my confidence that conservative principles still appeal to a majority of Americans, Republicans, independents, and Reagan Democrats.
George Will, is John McCain a conservative by your definition?
The day after he gave that talk to the Conservative Political Action Conference, I gave the main Ronald Reagan lecture and urged them to essentially give him a look, give him a chance, because more often than not, he's a conservative. Certainly, if you want to If you care about the federal judiciary, you'd rather he appoint the judges than Barack Obama, although it would not be helpful if he only appointed judges that thought McCain-Feingold, his signature legislation, was constitutional, which I do not. But basically, he does occupy the Senate seat, the one of Arizona's two Senate seats that was occupied by Barry Goldwater. He not as interested as I wish he were in domestic policy, which affects directly how our freedoms are preserved and exercised. It sometimes seems as though if it doesn't fly or explode, he's not that interested. He's just interested in national security. But on balance, a lot of conservatives, and I expect I, will do what his 95-year-old mother has recommended. That is, hold your nose and vote for my son.
And if he votes, if he takes the vote, if he should win the White House, will the apostate still be in power from your conservative vantage?
Different apostates. We always switch the apostates around. I will immediately go into semi-opposition the day after the votes are counted if John McCain wins, which I repeat, I do not expect him to do. But it's a columnist's job to be a loyal opposition to almost everybody, particularly if you're a conservative in Washington.
Let's take a call from Spokane, Washington. And Michael, you're on the air with George Will.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I want to disagree vehemently with one of the previous callers that said he appreciates Mr. Will's commentary. I used to, and I don't anymore. And part of the problem is something that you said earlier, where you talked about conservatives having truth and empiricism on their side. And I think the current incarnation, that's actually not true. For example, one of the things that I hear conservative pundits and politicians say constantly is that we can't roll back the Bush tax cuts because it was responsible for the economic growth that we have experienced over the past few years.
Hmm.
Empirically, if you looked at the data, that was driven by the housing market, which was driven by low interest rates. So if you look at the data, that simply doesn't hold water, yet they continue to make that argument. If you want to make another argument, fine, but that's misleading. The other thing is I think that there is a generation of conservative politicians and pundits that actually mislead, and I would actually say outright lie about things. You had Richard Vigory on your show ages ago, and I admire him immensely. There's a younger generation, Rich Lowry and Matthew Continetti, that I also admire.
Mm.
But there's a group in the middle that I think mislead us, and Mr. Will is guilty of that. He wrote a column about how the government is subsidizing digital television boxes. But he started it out saying that the government was giving low-income people subsidized HDTV, which is a different thing altogether. And you look at that and you think, wow, the government's giving poor people high-end electronics, which is not true. And so that's why I think conservatism is having a problem right now, is that people in the middle that are independents like me don't know whether we can believe them or not.
Michael, let us pick it up. George Will, did you run a correction on that?
I'm not sure I said HDTV. If I did, I'll go back and correct. Yes, it's interesting that the caller A said that is an example of lying. If I made a mistake, it was, I believe, not a lie, but an honest mistake. And B, it's interesting to me that in a lot of the mail, I get lots of mail, no one other than this caller has made that assertion.
But what about your assertion earlier in our conversation saying conservatives are impeccably empirical? Have the apostates hewed to that?
That's why they're called apostates.
Because they have not?
That's what they are apostates from, which is the reality principle. Let me explain why I can remain serene that the reality principle will serve conservatives. Between 1938 elections, when Roosevelt really overreached with his court-packing plan and was rebuked, between 1938 and 1964, the anti-Goldwater landslide, there was no liberal legislating majority in our country. Republicans and conservative Democrats could temper liberal ambitions. After the 64 election, particularly for 2 years, liberalism had its way in Washington, And in 1966, the conservative revival began in reaction to liberal overreaching. I think we could have that happen again.
In the opposite direction, starting 06, 2006, 08?
2006, I think, would be May, 2010 is, I think, going to be a much better year for Republicans.
Let me ask you, a little bit about Iraq here, and I want to get to Iran as well. But on this truth front, that was a real moment of trouble. You've become critical of the Iraq war, but there was a time when the assertions you were making didn't look so good afterward. Here's October 02, not long after Condoleezza Rice is talking about the U.S. not wanting a smoking gun to become a mushroom cloud. And here's your summary with talking with Charlie Rose about the case against Saddam Hussein.
So we know he has hegemonic designs, an insatiable appetite for astonishingly dangerous weapons. I mean, some of them. I mean, one of the biological weapons he has is a fungus, the primary role of which would be to cause an outbreak, a mass outbreak of liver cancer in children.
George Will, where's the fungus and where's the impeccable empiricism there?
I was wrong, and the company I was keeping in being wrong was the U.S., French, German, British, Italian, Chinese intelligence services. There was an amazing consensus on this, which we should all take as a cautionary lesson about the inability of us to vest confidence in all kinds of things. I certainly was wrong. As I say, there was an enormous number of people wrong, including, of course, a majority of both parties in both houses of the Congress of the United States. I would actually, from this, take renewed commitment to skepticism. For example, we spoke earlier in our conversation about the consensus, the scientific consensus that A, global warming is real. B, it has the following trajectory. C, it is caused by human beings, etc.
Right. I mentioned, I used that word. You did not.
That's right. And what I would just say that some of the skepticism that we have acquired, healthy impulse regarding U.S. intelligence, regarding weapons of mass destruction, etc., we might save just a bit of that skepticism for people who, with similar confidence today, say they know the trajectory of the planet's climate for the next 100 years.
But for how long? Until how many species go away? How many, miles of Myanmar are underwater, of American coast, for that matter?
Well, since it is 100% certainty at any point in the planet's history that it's either warming or cooling. We know we've had periods of global cooling, and I have the disadvantage of being 67, of having been in this business since the 70s, at which point the cover of Newsweek, April 28, I believe it was, 1975, had a cover on our cooling planet. The Washington Post carried stories about the armadillo fleeing Kansas, heading south to get away from the cooling. There was a comparable consensus just 30 years ago about glaciation in the north, about a crisis, a genuine crisis of global cooling. I've seen this movie before.
And you just don't buy it. And you're willing to say, put the brakes on the efforts to try and address it. You're willing to put
that... And I'll tell you why. John McCain says, with a kind of flippancy, well, if we're wrong about all this, all we do is leave our children a cleaner planet. Not true. If we're wrong about this, we have slowed economic growth with enormous costs in the development of medicines, culture, education, etc. We have cost lives, lots of lives, by skewing the world's wealth creation in pursuit of a chimera, that is the thermostat by which we're going to regulate the planet.
Let's go to Iraq. You've gotten very sour on that war. In the introduction to the new book, you call it perhaps the worst foreign policy debacle in the nation's history. What do you blame for that? I mean, conservatives were in charge for a long time before we entered that war. The Republican White House led the country very actively into the war. A lot of Democrats voted for it as well. But, I mean, does it teach you something about conservatism that we ended up there?
Yes. It teaches us that we should recur more faithfully to fundamental conservative insights, such as my support for the war had one point, which was weapons of mass destruction in the hands of a man who had already used them on his own people. You did not hear much from me about the joys of nation building. You did not hear me echoing, say, George W. Bush when he said, and he borrowed the phrase, by the way, from Ronald Reagan, that it is cultural condescension to say that some nations are not ready for democracy. It may be condescending. It's, of course, perfectly clear. I did not echo Tony Blair, who in his speech before a joint session of Congress 3 months after Baghdad fell, said it is a myth that our values are Western values, a product of our culture. No, he said, they are values shared by ordinary people everywhere. Again, that's false. Billions of people around the world do not define freedom the way we do not value it the way we do. They prefer institutionalized piety, national glory, ethnic solidarity. There are lots of competing values. A real conservative knows that the United States government, which has its handful running Amtrak, is going to have more than its hands full trying to broker peace in an ethnically divided semi-nation like Iraq.
You talked about, I forget the phrase, reality principle, reality something. Is it going to take a change in party to clear the apostates, in your view, out of Washington? If you've got Republicans there who have, you know, stepped away from impeccable empiricism, is it going to take a change in not just the majority in Congress, but in the White House to clean up the temple?
Yes, and bring in people who will do further damage to the temple. I mean, that's democracy. The transaction costs of democracy are lots of excesses and inefficiencies and irrationalities, and we're perfectly glad to pay them. But no one I know thinks that either liberalism or conservatism is ever going to or should ever rule indefinitely. We need markets correct. You know, we're going through eventually a recession. We're not in one yet, but probably we'll go into one. And another name for recession is a correction. What we're experiencing in the market, housing market, is a correction of a bubble. Just as at the end of the Clinton years, we experienced a correction in the bubble in tech stocks and all of that. That's the way the world works.
So it sounds like you're rooting for a Barack Obama win, if that's what it's going to take to bring the correction.
No, it's like rooting for or against a hurricane or an earthquake. I mean, these things happen without cheerleading.
Let's go to Bossier City, Louisiana, and William. William, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question goes back to what you were speaking about earlier about the distribution of wealth and the tax rates. George Will stated the percentages that the rich people pay. Of course, that's because they make the most money. My question is, how do you rationalize the fact that I pay a 35% tax rate and people like Warren Buffett pay a 15% tax rate?
Because he's paying on capital gains and you're paying on wages? What do you say, George?
Well, I think what your caller's referring to is the carried interest, which is a lot of what the hedge funds and others make is considered carried interest and taxed at 15. I don't have a dog in that fight. I think you can make a perfectly sound case that that should be treated as normal income, so I'm really not at odds with your caller. I would suggest that the caller and others like him, when they talk about the rich, do something the politicians rarely do when they talk about the rich, which is define them. For example, you know, if you are a Chicago policeman with 20 years service and a Chicago public school teacher with 20 years service, you're getting paid approaching $200,000. And is that rich? I don't think they feel rich.
I somehow doubt that that's what William is thinking about. Do you get worried about the level of income disparity in this country, of wealth disparity, as a conservative? Is there ever a point at which that becomes problematic, even in this market-loving nation of ours?
Sure. Is there ever a point?
Are we there?
We may be getting there. I don't know. I mean, there are two things. One is that are sensible market forces producing this? That's one question, but it's not dispositive. Another question that conservatives have to answer is, even if they answer yes to that, they have to say, is this perception of injustice undermining support for the system? The conservative argument for Franklin Roosevelt, and there is one, is that what the New Deal did, although often irrational and counterproductive and prolonging the Depression and all that, much of what he did by his sheer hyperkinetic approach to governance was give people faith that the system that was in crisis was salvageable and should be salvaged. So there are political reasons for doing things as well as economic reasons.
You don't want war with Iran. It sounds like we need a correction on a number of fronts. You want people to keep, you know, bought into the system. You say you're for John McCain, but I'm hearing arguments that lean the other way throughout, Dr. Will.
Well, I'm for, again, I'm a John McCain's mother, McCain supporter. The world doesn't serve up perfection, and I do understand that one of the essential conservative positions on life is that the perfect is the enemy of the good. If you find some good, settle for it.
George Will, his new book is One Man's America, The Pleasures and Provocations of Our Singular Nation. George, thank you very much for being with us today.
I enjoyed it.
Good to have you. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.